You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and I am here with an episode on the copycat effect. Copycat killers, I find it fascinating psychologically, why someone, an everyday, seemingly everyday person, would watch something on television, especially heinous and violent, and feel so compelled to act that out in real life. And there have been some really heinous and unfortunate copycat killings across the globe just over the last 20, 30 years. So we are going to dig into a few of them. But before we get into that, let's just get a little bit of housekeeping out of the way. First, you're listening, obviously, to We Saw the Devil. I'm your host, Robin. You can find us at WeSawTheDevil.com. From there, you can find us across all social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, as well as our Patreon. Beyond that, if you like this episode or you like the content of this podcast, please take 10 seconds and leave a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening on. It means the absolute world to us, and not just for this podcast, but for any podcast you're listening to. Countless hours go into every single episode. So if you like it, let us know. First, thank you so much for those of you who have reached out and shared your stories. In the previous episode, I discussed women and true crime, why women listen to true crime, and honestly, the links that women go to on a daily level almost as a result of their upbringing. Don't stay out too late, don't walk alone, watch your drink, you know, things like that. Steps that women take in order to basically not get murdered. I did a call out for personal stories, and I did get a handful. Now, those are actually going to be read in the next episode. So thank you guys so much for sharing. I will be reaching out to those of you who messaged. Unfortunately, I haven't had time as of yet. All of these are going to be read on the next episode. I find that it's empowering for other women to hear situations like this and how they were overcome or avoided. You know, some teachable, teachable moments, right? So that is going to be coming up this next week. This episode is a little bit late because y'all, I don't know about you guys, but it is hotter than the hinges on the gates of hell here. I know a portion of the United States right now is going through a really dangerous heat wave. I mean, here in Nashville, we've been hovering between like 93 and 98 with a feels like of about like 105 to 107 every single day. It is freaking miserable. My humidities are not faring well, and I do not appreciate it one bit. I am not built for heat. So I hope all of you listeners who are affected by this shit show are staying safe, hydrated, and that you're all filled with the joy and comfort that is central air conditioning. So before we get into the episode today, I just want to quickly touch on something that I've been watching this week. From the conversations that I've had with a handful of friends, my feelings, like, it's actually been a very common opinion. The Warren Jeffs documentary on Netflix, it's titled Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey. First of all, I am so tired of documentaries and stories about the FLDS and Warren Jeffs. I felt like if you've seen basically any documentary or even lengthy YouTube video on Warren Jeffs, you're pretty much set. Not really anything left to learn. Apparently, almost everyone I know feels the same way. But out of sheer curiosity, I decided to check this one out. The director, her name is Amy Berg. She actually made one of my favorite documentaries ever, Janis, Little Girl Blue, obviously about Janis Joplin. It's an incredible documentary. And she decided to tackle FLDS and Warren Jeffs. This is a 4-part documentary that goes over the FLDS church and Warren Jeffs, its leader. Pre-Warren Jeffs as the prophet and post-Warren Jeffs arrest. Now, for you listeners who may not be based in the U.S. or have absolutely no freaking idea who I'm talking about, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a radical offshoot of the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Basically, polygamy was officially outlawed in 1890 within the Mormon Church, so the FLDS was created in order to continue it. They're basically the redheaded stepchild. Mainstream Mormons try to disassociate themselves similar in the way that most Christians do from the Westboro Baptist Church. They're like, nope, stay away. The women aren't allowed to obtain education. They are literally enslaved to their husbands. The higher up in the church, the more wives you have. And it's estimated, well, not estimated, it's factual, that Warren Jeffs actually took 87 wives before he was arrested. And at the time of his arrest, at least 24 of them were under the age of 17. What's so important about polygamy, you might ask? I mean, in short, they believe that as a man, you're only going to receive salvation through plural marriage. And the more the merrier. And of course, the prophet is the one who is responsible for all marriages within the church. Women, especially young girls, are a literal currency. I mean, it's so incredibly sad. And side note, I think that one of my absolute favorite things in the entire world is seeing some of these women escape these polygamous cults that are out there. They come out so scared and broken, completely terrified of the Gentile world. They've been so indoctrinated their entire lives, being told how evil it is and that everyone outside of the FLDS church is going to hell or, you know, whatever sect. But I truly love watching these women escape, get help, jobs, education, really blossom and take off. And there's a good bit of that in this documentary, which is absolutely amazing. Now, there's actually a Showtime documentary as well called Prophets Pray, which has a lot of the same people in it who are interviewed, because there is a core group of women who are involved in the prosecution of Warren Jeffs and so forth. Now, the Showtime documentary is also stellar, but this one by Amy Berg is very stylized. So if you have any curiosity about Warren Jeffs, FLDS, or even the Lori Vallow case, I highly recommend it. That being said, make sure you do not have a heart condition, because I swear to God, my blood pressure shot through the roof. It's heartbreaking to hear all of these stories that range from incestuous child rape to the psychological manipulation and coercive control and abuse that the heads of the church committed upon its, you know, their members. It's horrible. But if you're interested in it, I highly recommend it. And I feel like there's been an astounding amount of true crime programming lately, but nothing has really hit the bullseye for me. So I was really surprised by this. The thing about Pam, I'm sorry guys, but I found it horrendous and a little trashy, to be honest. Yeah, I'm so sorry if you loved it, but I absolutely hated it. It wasn't what I was expecting. It wasn't what I wanted. I was expecting more of an actual dramatic retelling, like reenactment, rather than a cheesy Lifetime movie. Yet here we are. The Girl from Plainville on Hulu was exceptionally good, but it actually didn't do much to breathe fresh air into the case. So if you guys have any recommendations, please throw them out my way. Otherwise, for me, it's pretty much catching up on Catfish and the show's Welcome to Plathville. Also, for the last couple weeks, I've been watching Hacks, Gentleman Jack, and a couple other things. But yeah, I need some really good recommendations because vastly, nothing's really done it for me. So that being said, let's talk about the copycat effect and copycat crimes. First, let's define what the copycat effect is. The copycat effect is the tendency of sensational publicity about violent murders or suicides to result in more of the same through imitation. The copycat effect is a term that was invented by writer Lauren Coleman in his 2004 book, The Copycat Effect, How the Media and Popular Culture Trigger the Mayhem in Tomorrow's Headlines, which, chef's kiss, that is the most beautiful book title, an accurate book title I think I've ever heard. The first time that I ever heard of a copycat killer was the 1995 movie Copycat, starring Sigourney Weaver. In this film, she plays a criminal profiler who works with a detective on a case involving serial killings. Turns out, they are a copycat in recreating crimes committed by serial killers like Dahmer, Berkowitz, Bundy, and DeSalvo. I won't give away the big twist in this, but it is a great film and I highly recommend you see it. There are a lot of really great crime movies from the 90s. I feel like, you know, when you reach a certain age and you say things that are like, oh shit, I'm old now. This week, I feel like it's been nostalgia central for me. I'm like, the 90s were the best for music. The 90s, the best for movies. Constantly living my childhood from like the mid late 90s. But back to the relevant topic at hand, that's quite literally what it is. Copycat, imitation. Surprisingly, there hasn't actually been a lot of research or many studies done on this phenomenon until more recently. unfortunately, due to school and mass shootings here in the United States. You may remember the hoopla and controversy surrounding the 19-year-old Boston bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev appearing on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. His long, curly brown hair, likening him almost identical to that one classic photograph of The Doors' Jim Morrison. Readers were absolutely repulsed because it made him look like, how most people described, like a rock star. They refused to buy the issue, and news anchors and talking heads debated it for a week after its release. The common sentiment at that time was that it normalized this monster, this boogeyman who killed 3 and injured 264 people. And what I said at the time was, well, dum-dums, that's kind of the point. He was normal. He was a UMass Dartmouth student who posted stupid memes on Twitter, rated local cheeseburgers, loved fast cars. He posted about hot chicks in college. He wanted to become a marine biologist before he switched to a nursing degree. And above all, I thought he was human. He wasn't just a cartoon caricature of some bloodthirsty terrorist. In fact, the cover challenged the perception of the general public, because at that time, they had a very strong belief in how they wanted a terrorist to be depicted. So why not show how others viewed Dzhokhar before he shockingly committed an act of terror? And in my opinion, still today, that article is one of the best that Rolling Stone has ever published. It's absolutely incredible. I was 29 when the Boston bombing happened, and I was pretty off the mark with my opinion at that point. There's actually a great deal of reasoning why that cover from Rolling Stone magazine was a major issue, and only hindsight is 20/20. First, I'd like to state that the news media is one of the most important aspects of our society. And I'm not going to get into a debate or like engage the people over whether it's owned by the elite, if it's staged or propaganda or whatever. Regardless, the news media is important. That's an irrefutable fact. It brings awareness to different societal issues and changes the tide of public opinion. In terms of crime, it can inform the public and allow them to make personal decisions for their own safety. For example, if there is a shopping center near you that has near nightly muggings, would you go shopping there by yourself after dark? Probably not. And I hate to say this, but you know, it is America 2022. Let's say there's a mass shooting somewhere, movie theater, shopping mall, something like that. News media is so consumable now with our devices. News media is so consumable now, nearly immediately. So through notifications, apps, internet, our cell phones, our laptops, we are kept abreast of so many different things. But still, there's a dark side to the news, and that goes back to media contagion. When an exceptionally horrific and violent crime is committed, every single news organization covers it. I mean, that's a no-brainer. And this is where there's a fine line between journalistic integrity and sensationalism, at least in my opinion. I think that everyone knows at this point that news stations cover all the graphic, lurid details of heinous crimes for the clickbait, right? They get money every time someone clicks on that article and reads it and, you know, they're exposed to other ads. Or watching one of their news videos, you'll have to, you know, in a 3-minute video, you may have to watch 5 minutes of ads before you get there. It's because they're moneymakers. So with that clickbait title and headline, especially if it's, say, Orsulia Gall, the mother in New York a month or two ago, who was stabbed like 60 times by her lover. God, the headlines on that were everywhere. Gruesome discovery, mother almost decapitated, stuffed in bag. But we get hour to hour updates on horrible crimes nowadays. And in this, here's a question for you. Is a news outlet fulfilling its obligation of informing the public by covering, say, the Uvalde shooting nearly 24/7 on every outlet? Which they did. They covered that mass shooting 24/7 on almost every single outlet. But does the general public need to be made aware of all of the intimate details of the shooter's life? His thoughts? What about the Buffalo Tops Market shooting a few weeks ago? His manifesto was discussed and repeated hundreds of times across various media outlets. How explicit do you think news coverage on these things should be? The general consensus in academia for the last few years has been that no coverage should be given to the murderers or the graphic details of the crime scenes. After all, some killers, mass shooters or serial killers in particular, do it for the notoriety. To become that person on the news. To become that hero in some shitty Reddit or 4chan forum. And that's what we're going to be covering today. Here are a few cases where someone was inspired by crimes they saw on their TV, either via the news or via a fictional program. A handful of episodes back, I covered the 1982 Chicago Tylenol murders, where seven people died from taking Tylenol laced with potassium cyanide. That killer was never caught and still hasn't been. Like, it is a mystery. However, in 1986, Seattle, Washington resident Stella Nickel was. She was a Southern housewife who hated her husband, Bruce. So much so, in fact, that she decided to murder him in order to collect his life insurance policy. I have no idea what went into Stella's noodle in the planning of this. I'm pretty sure it was something to the effect of, oh, the Chicago Tylenol killer was never caught, nor the random copycats after. Stella girl, you got this. But the lie detector test determined that that was a lie. Stella did not, in fact, have it. Stella decided to lace Bruce's liquid gel Excedrins with, you guessed it, cyanide. She gave it to him one day while he was home, and Bruce collapsed on the floor and died, which is what happens when you take two pills of cyanide. To cover her tracks, Stella had also planted tainted bottles of Excedrin around Seattle, hoping that law enforcement would believe it to be just another copycat killer. After all, this was only 5 years after the Chicago episode of this, with Tylenol, so it was still very much in the public's consciousness. Seattle police ended up finding five more bottles of Excedrin that contained cyanide, and it led to massive recalls across the country once again. A break in the case only happened when Stella Nickel's own daughter, Cynthia Hamilton, went to police and reported that Stella had frequently spoken about wanting Bruce dead and had previously tried to poison him with foxglove. You see, 20 years prior, Stella was actually arrested for child abuse for beating Cynthia when she was just a small little girl. She beat her with a curtain rod. And apparently, Cynthia held on to that grudge because she told the FBI all about how her mother had checked out library books on poisons, and surely enough, the FBI followed up on that lead, investigated, and determined it to be true. Not only that, but they found the books that Stella Nickel had checked out from the library, and Stella's fingerprints were all over the pages for cyanide. Enter sad trombone noise here. The interesting part about this case is that she's actually now eligible for parole, and many women's rights groups, as well as her defense attorney, believe that she should be given a chance and released. She was sentenced to 90 years in prison, but still possessed the eligibility for parole. And all I have to say is, no thank you. Back in 2008, we had the Showtime show Dexter, the one about everyone's favorite vigilante serial killer. Also the one with that really disgusting subplot, you know, borderline incestuous with his adopted sister, Deb. Everyone was watching. Dexter was in season 3 at this point. Everyone was watching, including myself. But so was a Canadian filmmaker by the name of Mark Andrew Twitchell. Twitchell had received a modicum of fame online for writing and filming a Star Wars fan film that had a cameo from one of the original actors. In 2008, he was working on a short film in a garage that he rented in downtown Edmonton. One day in October of 2008, 38-year-old oil field worker John Brian Altinger informed his friends that he was meeting a woman that he had met on the dating website Plenty of Fish. Then, suddenly, those friends began to receive strange emails from him saying that the woman was taking him on an extended vacation to Costa Rica. His boss at the oil field also received an email with his resignation letter, but didn't write back and didn't respond to his request of a forwarding address for his final paycheck. And that's when people became suspicious. Altinger's friends actually ended up breaking into his condo, but found nothing amiss. They also found no proof of him going on a trip. None of his clothes were gone, no passport, nothing like that. So they contacted police, who launched a missing persons investigation and then very quickly a homicide investigation. But Mark Andrew Twitchell was already, he was ready for police. He already had his story straight. He told them yes, he had absolutely met Altinger, but it was because Altinger was selling him his Mazda, his car, in order to finance his trip to Costa Rica with some woman that he said he was recently seeing. The police, knowing that it was really actually Mark Andrew Twitchell behind that Plenty of Fish profile, impounded Andrew's car and laptop immediately. They found Altinger's blood in the trunk and a weird document on his laptop titled SK Confessions that Twitchell had attempted to delete. Twitchell was charged with murder that same day. But in that SK Confessions document, Andrew Twitchell detailed his entire history of becoming a wannabe serial killer. The opening lines read, "This story is based on true events. The names and events were altered slightly to protect the guilty. This is the story of my progression into becoming a serial killer." The journal detailed the writer's failed first attempt and successful slaying of a man that he lured into his garage by a fake dating profile. It also described the entire process of how he dismembered and chopped up the man's body, as well as the attempts at disposing of the remains. During the trial, Twitchell actually fully admitted to killing Altinger and writing the document. He tried to say that it was an act of self-defense and that the document was just a sensationalized account that he had planned to turn into some short film or novel. His first attempt of murder was against a man named Giles Tetrol, who successfully actually fought off Twitchell and escaped the garage, but he didn't report it to police. That entire story was actually told in the document as well, and police learned of this when they were contacted by Giles Tetrol. One passage from it described what he did after he cut off John Altinger's head. It read, quote, "I grabbed his jaw with my gloved hand and moved it while making a funny voice to make it look like he was talking, and chuckled to myself at the total silliness of it all." On April 12, 2011, Twitchell was convicted of first-degree murder for the death of Johnny Altinger and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for 25 years. Then there was Eddie Sada, a New York man who was obsessed with the Zodiac Killer, guns, and the Bible. He killed 3 and injured 7 between March 1990 to October 1993. He was arrested after a domestic disturbance where he shot his half-sister in the butt while she was in an argument with her boyfriend. Police came to the scene, searched the home, found satanic books, bombs, and a cache of weapons in his home. A member of the Zodiac unit actually recognized some of the symbols and were able to match saliva from a letter that Sada had sent the New York City police. He was obviously arrested and actually sentenced to 232 years in prison. Then there's the movie Scream, which has somehow inspired numerous copycat killers. And for those of you who know me personally, you know how much I love horror movies. The good ones, not the tits and ass garbage from the 80s. But I have no idea why people like Ghostface and the Scream movies. No idea whatsoever. I guess I don't get it. I think he looks so ridiculous and the movies are really lame. But I digress. In any case, this franchise, for some reason, has actually inspired a handful of killings, like Cassie Jo Stoddart, who was killed by Brian Draper and Tori Adamick in 2006, when they were just 16 years old. But the first and most notorious Scream copycat killing actually happened 5 years prior in 2001. Truck driver Terry Jaredon murdered 15-year-old Allison Cambier. Cambier and Jaredon were acquaintances, neighbors, and they lived just a couple houses apart from one another. They spoke frequently about their love of horror films and even exchanged DVDs. One day, like normal, Allison dropped by Jaredon's house to talk. On this day, though, Jaredon flirted with her and made some sexual advances. Allison made it very clear that she was not interested and very uncomfortable. So Terry Jaredon left the room, went into his bedroom, and returned wearing Ghostface's costume from the Scream movies. He had 2 huge knives, one in each hand, and fatally stabbed Allison 30 times. But get this, instead of trying to cover his tracks or clean up the crime scene, he laid her body out on his bed, put a rose in one of her hands, and then called his dad and one of his friends to give a full confession. When the police arrived on the scene after this obvious tip-off, Jaredon immediately confessed to killing Allison, saying that he was inspired by the Scream trilogy and that it had been a premeditated event. Jaredon ended up receiving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. And even Jack the Ripper had a copycat as recently as 2007. Derek Brown was obsessed with Jack the Ripper, although he didn't just solely target sex workers like Jack the Ripper did. Only one of his victims was actually a sex worker. However, the murders were just as brutal and actually took place in Whitechapel, London, the exact location of the Ripper murders from the late 1800s. He first killed a street vendor who sold DVDs. A month after that, he picked up a sex worker, Bonnie Barrett, picked her up in Whitechapel, and also murdered her. He was luckily captured entering a London subway with his first victim on the day of her disappearance. And that is actually how police were able to catch him, actually quite quickly. When they raided his flat in London in October of 2007, they found blood from the victims in the kitchen, the hallways, and the bathroom. The bathroom is apparently where he dismembered all of them, took their remains, and scattered them around. He had removed the carpets, scrubbed the walls, used a lot of bleach, but as we all know, you can't easily get rid of blood evidence. Also during the investigation, police found a DIY murder kit that he had, and that had a steam cleaner, a bow saw, and waterproof sheeting. After he was arrested, police were able to actually link him with 6 unsolved rapes, but he was not actually convicted of those. Derek Brown was a father of 7, and by all accounts, with every woman he'd ever dated, they said that he had a very big appetite for sex, especially sex workers. He was addicted to picking up sex workers. He was eventually sentenced to life in prison with a minimum sentence of 30 years. And by all accounts, even today here in 2022, he has shown no remorse whatsoever. Not only that, but he's actually refused to assist the police in finding the remains of the victims. So unfortunately, the families aren't even going to get closure in the murders. Michael Madison was another man who was inspired by a serial killer. From Cleveland, Ohio, he was inspired by Anthony Sowell, also known as the Cleveland Strangler. Sowell had actually been arrested just 3 years prior to Michael Madison going on his own spree. And for those of you who don't recall the Cleveland Strangler, he raped and murdered 11 women in Cleveland between 2007 and 2009. He was arrested, convicted, tried, and sentenced to death back in 2011. In Michael Madison's case, he killed at least 3 women. He's believed to have killed at least 3. And he idolized Anthony Sowell. He saw him as a model, as an inspiration. So much so, in fact, that Madison's ex-girlfriend said that he was fixated on the case, would watch YouTube videos and cry in sympathy with Anthony Sowell, a serial murderer, again, of 11 women. In July of 2013, police responded to a foul odor in a home in Cleveland, investigated a garage, and discovered a decomposing body. They obviously investigated, brought a team, and they found 2 more bodies inside. One was in the backyard, and the other one was in a basement. And this is just a vacant home that just really started smelling horribly to passersby. All of the victims were wrapped in plastic bags. So, obviously, police got a search warrant, entered Madison's apartment, and found, quote, further evidence of decomposition. There was a brief standoff, and then he was taken into custody. In July of 2013, he was charged with 3 counts of aggravated murder. He was sentenced to death. He filed a couple appeals, but in 2020, just 2 years ago, the Ohio Supreme Court voted unanimously to uphold the death sentence for him. And a side note on the Madison case, his mother, Diane Madison, was actually murdered in her home in 2019. She was murdered, and then 3 of her grandchildren were also injured in the stabbing attack. Apparently, her own grandson, Jalen Plummer, got a knife and went on a spree inside of her home, killed her, and injured 3 of her other grandchildren. He pled guilty to all charges, just immediately, and was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 30 years. And then we have perhaps the most notorious one of them all, natural born killers. And spoiler alert, Natural Born Killers is also probably in my top 10 of favorite films ever made. And nerdy fact, a lot of people think it was actually directed by Quentin Tarantino, and it was not. It was written, in fact, though, by Quentin Tarantino. This was when before Quentin Tarantino became famous, he was trying to make it in Hollywood, and so he decided to shop around a handful of his scripts. Warner Brothers ended up taking his script, but they didn't hire him to direct it. They chose Oliver Stone to direct it. And Oliver Stone, actually, in Quentin Tarantino's eyes, really fucked it up. I'm not a huge Quentin Tarantino fan as a whole, myself personally. But, you know, the entire point of Natural Born Killers is that it's 2 young people in love and they do all of this together. In a podcast interview that Quentin Tarantino did, he said that he's never fully watched Oliver Stone's version of his film. Can't bring himself to watch it past the opening scene at the diner. He said, quote, The point of the thing is that they unnaturally live for each other at the expense of everyone else on the planet. And the podcast host he was speaking to said, quote, "Their killing spree is the sacrament of their love." To which Tarantino said, "Absolutely." And Natural Born Killers is insanely violent. In the film, they kill 52 people on a massive killing spree. It's so violent that Entertainment Weekly back in 2006 called it the 8th most controversial film in history. And if you haven't seen it, which I'm assuming most of you probably have because it is a complete cult classic, but it has a hell of a cast. Juliette Lewis plays Mallory, Woody Harrelson plays Mickey, there's Robert Downey Jr., Tom Sizemore, Rodney Dangerfield, Tommy Lee Jones. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. And this is what I find so beautiful and ironic about this film is that it actually takes a look at the way and how media portrays criminals and violent crime. I mean, this is, it's so in your face in this film. And the level of violence is what makes it work. But it also spawned a whole host of copycats. We had the case of William Savage and Patsy Byers, where in 1995, 18-year-old Sarah Edmondson and her boyfriend Benjamin Darris, also 18, they basically spent the night at her family's cabin in Oklahoma, watched Natural Born Killers while they were tripping on acid, and decided, you know what, we need to do this too. This just seems like a great life decision for us. So they packed up her car and they started driving. They told their friends they were going to go to a Grateful Dead concert here in Memphis, Tennessee. Instead, they went to Mississippi, where Benjamin Darris killed William Savage, who was a cotton mill manager at the time, shot him in the head twice at point blank range. They then went on to Louisiana, where Sarah Edmondson shot Patsy Byers. But here's the thing. Patsy Byers actually survived, even though she became quadriplegic. And Patsy Byers was pissed. Because Sarah Edmondson and Benjamin Darris were not the brightest tools in the shed, they ended up getting arrested. And Patsy Byers was pissed, and she decided that she was going to sue. And so she hired an attorney, and she actually tried to sue Time Warner and Oliver Stone, saying that their recklessness in creating and producing this film makes them responsible, that they should be held accountable. Now, plot twist, William Savage was actually really close friends with author John Grisham, you know, that John Grisham. And John Grisham actually publicly put out a statement accusing Oliver Stone of being, again, reckless and irresponsible. And he said that filmmakers should be held accountable for their work if it incites the viewers to commit violent acts, which, no. But it was a huge deal in the media. I mean, that could potentially be what censorship, you know? What is art? That became a really big point in 1995 when all of this made it to press. And again, Patsy Byers took legal action against both Sarah Edmondson and Darris. And then after she put it out, she amended it to include Stone and Time Warner. All of that was eventually thrown out, but it led to a lot of interesting conversations on the news cycle. Sarah Edmondson has been released. She's out. If you're listening to this, Sarah, hi, I guess. But she actually served less than 12 years of a 30-year sentence. And a lot of people are really, really angry about that because she did almost murder someone in cold blood. And they probably wouldn't have stopped their spree, too, unless, you know, if they hadn't been caught. Benjamin Darris continues to serve out his prison term in Mississippi State Prison at Parchman, Mississippi. Then there was the Heath High School shooting, where 14-year-old Michael Carneal in West Paducah, Kentucky, went into school carrying six rifles and a .22-caliber Ruger handgun. He basically got to school and started shooting, and when he was done shooting, he just laid down the weapons and surrendered. So it wasn't, you know, modern America 2022, you know, 30 kids are dead type of situation. School shootings weren't as hugely commonplace as they are now, so this was a huge, 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 huge ordeal. After he was arrested and he was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole, the parents of the murdered kids got together and filed a lawsuit again against a whole bunch of different companies. Everything from like Atari, Nintendo, New Line Cinema, Time Warner, Sony for computer games, like for Doom. They specifically added Natural Born Killers into the lawsuit, as well as a bunch of other random things like the video game Doom, Resident Evil, Mortal Kombat, even the movie Basketball Diaries starring Leonardo DiCaprio. And this is also one of the first times that a child blamed a video game for the crime. Carneal actually said that the video game Doom had made him good with target practice. This entire lawsuit, though, was thrown out. Then we have the Columbine High School Massacre. Everyone knows what Columbine is. If you don't, Google it. You'll be down a rabbit hole for the next 3 years of your life. But the point here is that Eric and Dylan, particularly Eric, used the initials NBK as their code in the private journals that he was keeping. In one article on April 10th, he wrote, "When I go NBK and people say things like dot, 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 they constantly reference natural born killers as more of an act." So they were really referencing the film as a violent act in itself. They even refer to the day of the shooting, April 20th, as, quote, "the holy April morning of NBK. Then we have the Richardson family murders, where Jeremy Allen Steink and his 12-year-old girlfriend, by the way, he was 23 years old, had a 12-year-old girlfriend, Jasmine Richardson, they murdered her parents together, as well as her 8-year-old brother. And natural born killers came into play here because he told his friends that the night before the murder, he had apparently watched it, and he told his friends that he was going to go natural born killers on her family. In more school shooting news, Frontier Middle School in Moses Lake, Washington. 14-year-old Barry Lucatus basically dressed himself up as a Wild West cowboy, had two handguns and a hunting rifle, went in and opened fire. He killed two students and one teacher. He was eventually de-armed and held until police arrived. He was obsessed with violent games, books, and natural born killers. And apparently he had actually rented Natural Born Killers 7 times and would constantly quote it to friends. So if you're seeing a theme here in like the mid-90s, especially right after it came out to the late 90s, Natural Born Killers and the quest of is media, like film, television, and video games, is this causing children to act like this, was a big thing and constant point on the news. The blog of Dawson College shooter Kim Veer Gill said that his favorite film was Natural Born Killers. He ended up killing one person at Dawson College in Montreal, Canada, and injured 19 others. He ended up killing himself after the shooting, but still, it was listed and very publicized that his favorite movie was Natural Born Killers. And there's a whole bunch of others, like 1994, a little 14-year-old boy decapitated one of his classmates. Why did he do it? He told officers that he wanted to be famous like Natural Born Killers. October of 1994, Nathan Martinez from Bluffdale, Utah, shot his stepmother and 10-year-old half-sister while they were sleeping at night. He then stole a car and then went on the lam and was found in Nebraska 3 days later. Before the killing, he apparently shaves his head bald and then wore the same style of like really round vintage sunglasses that Mickey does in the movie as well. Surprise, surprise, Natural Born Killers was one of his favorite movies as well. 1995, Jason Lewis shot and killed his parents after he watched Natural Born Killers and decided that he wanted to be just like Mickey and Mallory. He told his friends that very same thing. In June of 1995, two men broke into the home of a 65-year-old physically handicapped man and stabbed him 27 times with a knife. It was apparently one of the bloodiest crimes in Massachusetts history. It was so violent and so just strong that his body was split open from his clavicle to his spine. After this murder, the main perpetrator bragged to his girlfriend and was like, "Haven't you seen Natural Born Killers before?" And not only that, but during the interrogation, the other murderer quoted the movie and said, "We know what we did was bad, but we didn't know the guy, so we weren't going to cry about it." I can keep going for probably 2 more hours on a list of supposed copycats from people who watch Natural Born Killers, but it is in fact one of the biggest films of all time in the copycat killer section. But how do you guys feel about it? These are two very separate conversations in terms of the modern coverage on mass shootings and whether we should, report all the graphic details on mass shootings. I mean, hell, even researchers now are saying, guys, nothing's being done at this point. Nothing happened after Sandy Hook. Nothing happened after any of these other mass school shootings. Maybe it's time to start showing the bodies of these 7-year-old children. Maybe that will actually change the tide of support for gun reform and things like that. I mean, that's kind of like where sentiment is right now these days due to just sheer disgust with our current situation. I find it incredibly interesting that it seems like some people, maybe they're predisposed to it psychologically, but they'll watch something or see something on the news and then just be inspired to imitate it. I guess I don't understand, but here we are talking about them on this podcast. But that's it for today. Again, the next episode is going to be more on women and true crime, as well as reading some listener-submitted personal stories surrounding that. Again, you've been listening to We Saw the Devil. I'm Robin. Don't forget to check out our website at wesawthedevil.com. From there, you can find all of our social media, our Patreon, our merch, all of our good stuff. Stay safe. Stay cool, everyone. This heat wave is not over. Until next crime.